Chapter 34. Massard's security guards captured them 20 minutes later, after they rode inside an empty container car up to the surface from the waste storage cavern. They had dropped from the roof of the container and into the emptied interior. A concealed TV camera had caught them in an unguarded moment before they could slip inside. The door was thrown open moments before the container was to be lifted onto a railroad car. They had no chance of putting up any fight or making an attempt to escape. The surprise was well coordinated and complete. 10, Pitt counted them, 10 men standing with menacing steadiness, pointing machine guns at the 2 unarmed men inside the cargo container. Pitt felt the stinging bitterness of failure cut through him like a knife. He could taste the bitterness of defeat on his tongue. To be trapped and caught once by Massard was a miscalculation. To be caught twice was damn stupid. He stared at the guards, feeling no fear, only anger for getting snared. He cursed himself for not being more alert. They could do nothing now but bide their time and hope they weren't executed before another chance at escape, no matter how slim, appeared. Pitt and Giordino slowly raised their hands and clasped them behind their heads. "I hope you'll forgive the intrusion," Pitt said quietly, "but we were looking for a bathroom." "You wouldn't want us to have an accident," Giordino added.
"Still, both of you."
A voice erupted from a security officer in a smartly creased uniform, a red pillbox cap of the French military perched on his head. The tone was harsh and cold in English, with almost no trace of French.
"I'm told you are dangerous men. Push all thoughts of escape from your minds. My men are not trained to wound resisting captives."
"What's the big deal?" asked Giordino with an innocent look. "You act like we stole a drum of used dioxin." The officer ignored Giordino's remark. "Identify yourselves." Pitt stared at him. "I'm Rocky, and my friend is..." "Bullwinkle," Giordino finished. A tight smile curled the officer's lips. "No doubt more appropriate than Dirk Pitt and Albert Giordino."
"So if you know, why ask?" said Pitt.
"Mr. Massard was expecting you." "The last place they'd expect us to cut and run is the middle of the desert," said Giordino, mimicking Pitt's words in Borem. "Kind of misguessed, didn't we?" Pitt lightly shrugged his shoulders.
"I read the wrong script."
"How did your men penetrate our security?" asked the officer.
"We took the train," answered Pitt easily, making no attempt to hide the truth.
"The doors to the cargo containers are locked with combinations after loading. You could not have forced your way inside while the train was moving."
"You should tell whoever monitors your television cameras to study the air conditioners on the roofs. A simple matter to remove a panel and use it as a screen."
"Indeed." Captain Brunon was highly interested.
"Most clever. I'll see that your means of entry is added to our security manual."
"I'm deeply flattered," Pitt grinned. The officer's eyes narrowed.
"You won't be for long, rest assured."
He paused and spoke into a portable radio. "Mr. Massard?"
"I'm here," Massard's voice rasped through the speaker.
"Captain Charles Brunon, sir, Chief of Security."
"Pitt and Giordino?"
"In my hands."
"Did they resist?"
"No, sir, they gave up quietly."
"Please bring them to my office, Captain."
"Yes, sir, as soon as they've been decontaminated."
Pitt said to Brunon, "Would it help if we said we're sorry?"
"It seems American humor never stops," said Brunon coldly. "You can offer your apologies to Mr. Massard in person, but since you destroyed his helicopter, I wouldn't expect any pity if I were you." Yves Massard didn't smile often, but he was smiling now as Pitt and Giordino were escorted into his vast office. Leaning back in his expensive leather executive's chair, elbows parked on the armrests, fingers entwined under his chin, he smiled benignly like a mortician after a typhoid epidemic. Felix Varenne stood by a window overlooking the facility. His eyes stared expressionless, like camera apertures, the lines in his face grim, his mouth tight with contempt. A marked contrast to his superior's bemused stare.
"Splendid work, Captain Brunon," Massard purred. "You collected them uninjured and unmarked."
He gazed speculatively at the 2 men standing before him in clean white coveralls, at their tanned faces and excellent physical condition, took note of their seemingly unconcerned expressions, and remembered encountering the same indifference on his houseboat.
"So they proved cooperative." Like school children beckoned to class, Brunon said formally, they did as they were ordered.
Very wise of them, Massard murmured approvingly.
He pushed back his chair and came around the desk and faced Pitt.
I compliment you on your passage across the desert. General Kazim doubted you would last 2 days. A remarkable accomplishment to have come so far over hostile ground so fast.
General Kazim is the last man I'd rely on for a prediction, said Pitt pleasantly.
You stole my helicopter and crashed it in the river, Mr. Pitt. That will cost you dearly.
You treated us shabbily aboard your houseboat, so we repaid you in kind.
And General Kazim's valuable old car?
The engine seized up, so we burned it, Pitt lied.
You seem to have developed a nasty habit for destroying other people's expensive possessions.
I broke all my toys when I was a kid, Pitt said casually, drove my dad up the walls.
I can always purchase another helicopter, but General Kazim cannot replace his avion voisin.
Enjoy what time you have left before his sadists work you over in his torture chambers.
Lucky for me, I'm a masochist, Giordino said, unruffled.
Just for a second, Massard looked amused, then his face turned curious.
What did you find that was so interesting that you drove halfway across the Sahara to Fort Fourreau? He demanded.
We enjoyed your company so much on your houseboat, we thought we'd pay you another social visit.
Massard's hand lashed out as he viciously backhanded Pitt across the face, a large diamond ring cutting a path through the right cheek.
Pitt's head twisted from the blow, but his feet remained firmly rooted to the carpet.
Does this mean you're challenging me to a duel? He muttered through a taut grin.
No, it means I am going to have you slowly lowered in a drum of nitric acid until you talk.
Pitt looked at Giordino, then back to Massard and shrugged.
All right, Massard. You've got a leak.
Massard frowned.
Be specific.
Your hazardous waste, the chemicals you're supposed to be burning, are seeping into groundwater that flows under an ancient riverbed and is polluting every well between here and the Niger. From there it flows to the Atlantic, where it's causing a catastrophic disaster that will eventually destroy all sea life. And that's just for starters. We followed the old riverbed and discovered it once flowed directly beneath Fort Fourreau.
We are almost 400 kilometers from the Niger, said Varenne. Impossible for water to flow that far under the desert surface.
How do you know? Asked Pitt.
Fort Fourreau is the only project or plant within Mali that receives chemical and biological waste. The compound responsible for the problem can only come from here, the only possible source. There's no question in my mind now that I know that you're hiding waste instead of burning it.
Irritation flickered at the edge of Massard's mouth.
You're not entirely correct, Mr. Pitt. We do burn waste at Fort Fourreau. A considerable amount, as a matter of fact. Come into the next room and I'll show you.
Captain Brunon stood back and gestured for Pitt and Giordino to follow Massard. He led them across a hall into a room whose center was filled by a three-dimensional scale, cutaway model of the Fort Fourreau Hazardous Waste Disposal Project. The layout was elaborate, the detail so meticulous it was like looking at the real thing from a helicopter.
Is this mock-up true to life or a fantasy land? Asked Pitt.
What you see is an exact representation, Massard assured him.
And you're about to give us a no-frills, fact-filled lecture on its operation.
A lecture you can take with you to the grave, Massard said reproachfully.
He picked up a long ivory pointer and aimed its tip at a large field on the south side of the project, covered with huge flat modules slanted toward the sun.
We are completely energy-sufficient, Massard began. We produce our own electricity with this photovoltaic grid system of flat-plate solar cell modules made from polycrystalline silicon that covers 4 square kilometers. Are you familiar with photovoltaics?
I know that it's rapidly becoming the world's most economical energy source, answered Pitt.
As I understand it, photovoltaics is a solar technology that converts the sun's power into direct current electrical energy.
Quite right, said Massard.
When sunlight, or what scientists refer to as solar photon energy, strikes the surface of these cells after its 115 million kilometer journey from the sun, a flow of electricity is produced, enough to operate a project 3 times this size should we wish to expand.
He paused and aimed the pointer at a structure near the array of modules.
This building houses the generators powered by the energy converted from the modular field and the battery subsystem where the energy is stored for nighttime use or for days when the sun does not shine,
which is a rarity in this part of the Sahara.
Efficient, said Pitt. An efficient power system. But your array of solar concentrators, they do not operate with the same degree of effectiveness?
Massard looked thoughtfully at Pitt. He wondered why this man always seemed a step ahead of him. He swung the pointer toward a field next to the solar cells that held the array of parabolic trough collectors Pitt had observed the day before.
They do, he replied icily. My solar thermal technology for the destruction of hazardous wastes is the most advanced program of any industrial nation. This field of superconcentrators delivers solar concentrations higher than the normal light of 80,000 suns. This high-intensity sunlight, or photon energy, is then focused into the first of two quartz reactors.
Massard paused to touch the pointer against a miniature building.
The first breaks the toxic waste down into harmless chemicals at a temperature of 950 degrees Celsius. The second reactor, at temperatures around 1200 degrees Celsius, incinerates any remaining infinitesimal residue. The destruction of every known man-made toxic chemical is total and complete.
Pitt looked at Massard with respect mixed with doubt.
This all sounds very thorough and final. But if your detoxification operation is a state-of-the-art wonder of utility, why are you hiding millions of tons of waste underground?
Very few people are aware of the staggering number of chemicals that are spread around the globe. There are over 7 million known man-made chemical compounds, and each week chemists create 10,000 new ones. At current rates, over 2 billion tons of waste are accumulating around the world every year. 300 million alone in the United States. Twice that in Europe and Russia. More than double that amount when you throw in South America, Africa, Japan, and China. Some is burned by incinerators. Most is illegally dumped in landfills or discharged in water supplies. There is no place for it to go. Here in the Sahara, far from the crowded cities and farmlands, I have provided a safe place for international industries to send their toxic waste. At the moment, Fort Faro can destroy over 400 million tons of hazardous waste a year. But I cannot destroy it all, not until my solar thermal detoxification projects in the Gobi Desert and Australia are completed to handle waste from China and nations of the Far East. For your interest, I also have a facility only 2 weeks away from startup in the United States.
Very commendable, but that doesn't excuse you from burying what you can't destroy and charging for it.
Massard nodded. Cost efficiency, Mr. Pitt. It's cheaper to hide toxic waste than destroy it.
And you follow the same line of logic for nuclear waste, said Pitt accusingly.
Waste is waste. As far as humans are concerned, the only basic difference between nuclear and toxic is that one kills with radioactivity and the other with poison. Dump and forget it, and to hell with the consequences.
Massard gave an indifferent shrug.
It has to go somewhere. My country has the largest nuclear energy program in the world, second only to the United States in number of reactors in operation to generate electricity. Two radioactive waste repositories are already in operation, one at Sulen, the other at La Manche. Unfortunately, neither was designed to dispose of long-life or high-level nuclear waste. Plutonium-239, for example, has a half-life of 24,000 years. There are other radioactive nuclides that have half-lives 100 times longer. No containment system will last more than 10 or 20 years. As you have discovered on your uninvited expedition into our storage cavern, we receive and dispose of the high-level waste here.
Then, despite your holier-than-thou speech on hazardous waste management, your solar detoxification project is a front.
Massard smiled thinly.
In a sense, yes. But as I've explained, we actually destroy a high amount of waste.
Mostly for appearances' sake, Pitt said, his voice cold and compelling. I give you credit, Massard, building this phony project without international intelligence agencies getting wind of it. How did you fool spy satellites while you excavated your storage caverns?
Nothing really, Massard said arrogantly. After I built the railroad to bring in construction workers and materials, the excavation began under the first building erected. The soil was secretly removed and loaded in the empty railroad containers returning to Mauritania and used for a landfill in the nation's port city,
A profitable ongoing project, I might add.
Very shrewd. You get paid for the waste coming in and for the sand and rock going out.
I never stop at seeking merely one advantage, Massard said philosophically.
No one is the wiser and no one complains, said Pitt. No environmental protection agencies threatening to close you down, no international uproar over polluting underground water systems. No one questions your methods of operation, particularly the corporations that produce the waste, and who are only too glad to get rid of it for a price.
Varenne's expressionless gaze rested on Pitt.
There are few saints who practice what they preach when it comes to saving the environment, he said coldly. Everyone is guilty, Mr. Pitt. Everyone who enjoys the benefits of chemical compounds, from gasoline to plastics to water purification and food preservatives. It is a case of the jury secretly agreeing with the guilty. No one man or organization can control and destroy the monster. It is a self-propagating Frankenstein that it is too late to kill. So you make it worse by feeding on it in the name of profit. Instead of a solution, you've created a hoax.
Hoax?
Yes, by reneging on the expense of building long-lasting waste canisters and excavating deep deposit chambers several kilometers underground in geologically stable rock formations far beneath existing water tables.
Pitt turned from Varenne to Massard. You're nothing more than a shyster contractor who charges exorbitant prices for inferior construction that endangers lives.
Massard's face went red, but he was a master at controlling anger.
The threat of waste leakage 50 or 100 years from now, killing off a few sand beggars, matters little.
That's easy for you to say, said Pitt, his face hardened in scorn. But the leakage is occurring today, and desert nomads are dying as we talk. And lest we forget that, what you've caused here could affect every living life form on Earth.
The threat of guilt for killing off the world made no impression. But the reference to dying nomads triggered something in Massard's mind.
Are you working in concert with Dr. Frank Hopper and his World Health Inspection team?
No, Giordino and I are strictly on our own.
But you are aware of them?
Pitt nodded.
I'm acquainted with his biochemist, if that makes you happy.
Dr. Eva Rojas, said Massard slowly, watching for the effect.
Pitt saw the trap, but with nothing to lose, he decided to string along.
Good guess.
Massard didn't become brilliantly successful by winning a lottery. He was a master of deception and intrigue, but his greatest asset was insight.
I'll make another guess. You were the man who saved her from General Kazim's assassins outside of Cairo.
I happened to be in the neighborhood, yes. You're in the wrong business, Massard. You missed your calling by not becoming a palm reader.
To Massard, the novelty of the confrontation was wearing off. He was not used to being talked down to. For a man who controlled a vast financial empire on a day-to-day basis, wasting time with a pair of unwelcome interlopers was merely an annoyance to be pushed aside and handled by employees.
He nodded at Varenne. Our little talk has ended. Please arrange for General Kazim to take these men into custody.
Varenne's statue face finally broke into a python grin.
With pleasure.
Captain Brunon did not come from the same mold as Massard or Varenne. A product of the French military establishment, he may have resigned for triple wages, but he still retained a level of honor.
Begging your pardon, Mr. Massard, I wouldn't turn a rabid dog over to General Kazim. These men may be guilty of trespassing, but they certainly don't deserve to be tortured to death by ignorant barbarians.
Massard considered Brunon's comment for a moment.
Quite right, he said, strangely agreeable. We can't lower ourselves to the level of the general and his butchers.
A gleam came to his eyes as he stared at Pitt and Giordino.
Transport them to the gold mines at Tabeza. He and Dr. Rojas can enjoy each other's company while they dig in the pits.
What about Kazim? Asked Varenne. Won't he feel cheated out of making them pay for destroying his car?
No matter, Massard said with utter unconcern. By the time he discovers their whereabouts, they'll be dead.